You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Sean Green was a baseball major leaguer for nearly 14 seasons, a two-time All-Star who played for the Toronto Blue Jays, the Los Angeles Dodgers, the Arizona Diamondbacks, and the New York Mets. He drove in 100 runs four times, scored 100 runs four times, hit 40 or more home runs three times, led the league in doubles, extra base hits, and total bases, won both a Gold Glove Award and a Silver Slugger Award, and set the Dodgers' single-season record in home runs. And although he retired when he was just 34, he holds or is tied for a number of major league records. I'm not going to list them all right now, but some of them are really surprising. You may not know that Sean Green holds those records. He also had a reputation throughout the league for being an active supporter of countless charities. He's written a book with the help of Gordon McAlpine called The Way of Baseball, Finding Stillness at 95 Miles Per Hour. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It's my pleasure to welcome Sean Green to our show today. Hello.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Your retirement after the 2008 season came as something of a surprise for fans. You were only 34, which is relatively young for a successful major leaguer, and at the time of your retirement, you were one of only four active players with at least 300 home runs, 1,000 runs in RBIs, 400 doubles, and a .280 batting average, also 150 stolen bases. Had you accomplished all you'd wanted to accomplish?
I was ready to move on to other things. The biggest thing was my family. My opportunities were back east, and even though I had decided to retire, some good opportunities came up. I live in California, and I was just it was more important to me to be home with my kids, and they were starting to get to that school age. I didn't want to move them all around the country.
And you don't miss playing at all?
Of course I miss playing. I love baseball, and I do miss hitting on a regular basis because it's such a it's such a challenge, and there's so many moving parts that it's a constant daily struggle, much like life, and that's kind of where the book comes in, is it all ties together.
And it's often a total mystery to the non-player how somebody who has had a wonderful career and could hit everything suddenly can't hit anything.
Yeah, it happens.
I'm sure players think about it too.
It can come and go overnight. And I think more than any other sport, there's so much. Ted Williams says it's the most difficult thing to do in sports. So, I mean, I guess that's coming from a baseball player as well.
But even the best guys only get a hit one out of three times.
Yeah, and coming up, I didn't really understand that coming up to the major leagues. And then when I saw some of my favorite players as a child, Ricky Henderson, for example, another former Met, struggling and searching for a swing. I saw Paul Molitor in my first full rookie season in 95, had a rough year, and coming up to me as a rookie saying, what am I doing wrong? I don't know what I'm – and I just realized right then at an early age that it's universal. If you're going to wear a baseball uniform and play in the big leagues, you're going to struggle.
Well, the rap on you in the early days was that you couldn't hit left-handed pitching.
Yeah, and that was – something that really frustrated me at the time, because I had always done well in the minor leagues against left-handed pitching and just wasn't given the opportunity, and then the label kind of got thrown on me. And that, you know, led to a little bit of a contentious time with my manager, Cito Gaston, and hitting coach at the time, Willie Upshaw.
And they were giving you advice that you didn't think was good advice?
Well, they were, at the time, especially 96, John Olerud and myself were...
He was a guy who could hit a pitch in the middle of a snowstorm.
Oh, no, he could hit. He's a tremendous hitter, and he was kind of the guy that I emulated because he's a little taller than I am, but similar swing, similar approach, line drives to left center field, gap to gap. And they saw both of us as tall guys, and they wanted to hit more home. Well, they wanted us to hit more home runs and become more of a pull hitter style. And so they really kind of forced us to do different drills that were really screwing us up. And at one, finally in 97, I just kind of put my foot down and said, I'm not going to do it anymore. And they banned me from the cage, and I was on my own. That's where I grabbed my batting tee, went into a little net right off the dugout, and just started hitting there every day. And that tee work became my meditation that extended through the rest of my career.
A lot of athletes discover that or start to feel that they owe something to society after they achieve success. But you started very early, didn't you?
Yeah, it was something that I guess from the time I started, I never really felt like an entitled athlete. Sometimes I'd stand out in the field and look around and I'd be shocked that everyone's looking at me as a major leaguer, because I was always a huge fan of the game as a kid, and I put these athletes on pedestals, and it never really connected in my brain that I was suddenly other kids' idols. And I think, you know, that kind of kept me humble and, you know, kept me wanting to give back and be a good member of society.
So you gave away money from the start, didn't you?
I did. And my first, when I was 18, and I signed with the Blue Jays out of the first round of the 20 years ago, out of the draft, which is going on early June. My agent, Jeff Morad, who's now the owner of San Diego Padres, encouraged me to get back right away. And I signed a letter of intent to play for Stanford, and I was really torn. I didn't want to leave them high and dry. And I eventually did sign, didn't play for them. And I donated some money to Stanford. I donated some money to my high school and to a charity up in Toronto.
The Metropolitan Toronto Housing Authority Breakfast Club.
Yeah, it was something I wanted to do, something that was geared towards children, and they helped feed kids, and I thought it was a great cause, and it's something that I was proud to be associated with.
My guest is Sean Green, who's written a book called The Way of Baseball, Finding Stillness at 95 Miles Per Hour. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and the title suggests you're doing a variant on The Way of Tao. Are you a devotee of Eastern religious thought?
I am. I look at more as a philosophy, and I wouldn't say I'm religious in any way. I purposely didn't make the title the Zen of baseball or the Tao of baseball.
Phil Jackson was in L.A. when you were in L.A.
He was. I actually talked to him a few months back and gave him a copy of an earlier version of the book. And it's definitely along those lines. But I really found, when I was a senior in high school, I read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and that kind of, it resonated with me and kind of set me on this little path. And as I was reading the different books and practicing some meditation and learning different things, I found such a connection with baseball and with especially hitting that it was a natural fit for me, and it really changed my career.
Well, you say that you didn't have all that strong religious feelings, but you had a streak of 415 consecutive games played, and on September 26, 2001, you chose to sit out a game because it took place on Yom Kippur.
Yes, and I did that two other times in the future, 2004 and 2007 with the Mets. But for me, it was more about being a Jewish role model than it was about the religious aspect. I wasn't raised in a particularly religious household, and but I knew early on that a lot of Jewish baseball fans were looking to me, and I met with Sandy Koufax several times in spring training and always went to dinner with him at least once a spring and talked to him about it. And his advice was to do what I felt was right. He did what he felt was right, and that's what all there comes down to.
Well, although you weren't any threat to Cal Ripken Jr.'s no. record, that still had to be a difficult decision because 415 consecutive games is an awful lot. Most players get hurt, even, you know, just sliding into a base. Or yesterday, Carlos Beltran hit a foul ball off of his shin, and he's out for a while.
Yeah, I mean, it was a difficult decision for a couple reasons. The first was that we were playing the Giants, and we were two or three games behind them. So obviously, it's late in the year when Yom Kippur falls and right in the pennant race. So that was decision number one. And decision number two was I was really proud to have played that streak, because my first 3 years I was spending a lot of time on the bench when left-handed pitchers were pitching. And I was, in my mind, I said, as soon as I get a chance to play every day, I'm not coming out, whether Randy Johnson's pitching or, you know, if I have something going on with my legs or my arm or whatever the case may be, I want to be in there on a daily basis.
There were some pitchers you'd rather not face, like Randy Johnson, at his peak?
Randy was – I actually did well against Randy. Randy which I discussed in the book, he tipped his pitches, and I got very adept at picking up pitches.
And others didn't notice that?
Randy guys did notice, because he did it early before when he first started his windup. Mm-hmm. His glove was a little rounder on his slider, and it was a little skinnier on his fastball. And for me, that equated to much more success than I possibly would have had, because he was an intimidating figure. But there's some other guys I talk about in the book that not too many people did have, like Greg Maddux. I knew his pitches from the windup.
Really? And what a great pitcher he was.
Yeah, exactly. He was a tremendous pitcher, and he was a student of the game, of pitching. And so I was actually sort of surprised when I finally found that, but it led to some great success against him. And actually, even though I didn't have his pitches when he was in the stretch, which you'd rather have because obviously his runners on base, what he did in the windup dictated how he's going to pitch me in the stretch. So.
But still, knowing that a pitch is going to be here, there, or somewhere else, that still doesn't mean you're going to be able to hit it, does it?
Of course not, but it makes a huge difference if you know what's coming. And
if you know it's going to be outside, for example, a curveball outside?
Yeah, well, location's great. Location's more if a fastball is going to be inside, you really want to know that, because that's when you almost have to cheat a little bit if a guy's throwing 95 miles an hour to get to it. But then there's guys like Marwin Rivera that doesn't matter. I knew every pitch was going to be an inside fastball, and I couldn't hit it to save my life. So.
Keith Hernandez seems to be able to remember every pitch that he had in an important at-bat. He once said, well, he threw me a curveball outside and then a fastball inside. And we went through a whole at-bat here, and I thought, how the heck could anybody remember something that happened in 1994 in that much detail? But are you in this heightened situation where you would remember those things?
Definitely. I mean, it's weird. I can't remember faces or names or, what a conversation was. I could have the president call me up and have a conversation. I wouldn't remember it as well as I would remember specific instances on the field. It just gets imprinted in your brain because it's such a heightened time.
Well, in the book, you talk a lot about stillness, space, and awareness. And so these are meditation concepts that you could apply to baseball?
Yeah, I did. I started off the tee with just finding this meditation, which I refer to as stillness, just that the mind is kind of gone, and it's just getting absorbed in the feel of it, the sounds of the bat hitting the ball hitting the net, and just really concentrating on breathing, and that became a meditation. And then as that expanded out into batting practice, I started to kind of find some other things that my swing actually had. There was a little space in there from the time I got to the middle of my swing before my bat came forward, and that's where I found all my power to come out of.
And why do you think more players don't do this, or why do you think that it's a rare Asian player who really does well? Maybe the best hitter of this generation is Japanese, but most Japanese players don't become stars in the American major leagues.
Yeah, I mean, some of the players that I played with that were actually very Eastern in approach, but both of them were actually very Christian and would probably deny that they were very Eastern in their approach. But it was Tony Fernandez, former Yankee and Met, and Julio Franco. I mean, they both, and he played in Japan for a couple seasons.
Well, Julio Franco, of course, could play until he was 60 years old.
Pretty much. He could. He definitely could.
You probably could have as well. Did you find that playing in certain markets affected your game? You went from Toronto to Los Angeles. That must have been... Well, first of all, you're returning home to some degree when you went to L.A.
Yeah, I came back to L.A. with a lot on my shoulders. One, I was hometown coming back. Two, I was a Jewish player coming into a large Jewish market. And three, the team had struggled for a while and were really looking to fill the void of Mike Piazza, who was spent the latter part of his career with the Mets. So they were looking to me to do all these things. I had a huge contract and a lot of expectations based on the last two seasons I had in Toronto. So it definitely affected my game, especially that first year. It was tough.
Did you spend some time in Japan yourself?
I went to Japan after that 2000 season on one of those all-star tours. And it really helped me kind of find things because I started off, when I got picked for the U.S. all-star team, I was off to a great start. And then everything kind of caved in at that point, and the last 4 months were quite a struggle. So I probably wouldn't have made that team if they had picked it at the end of the season. But once I was there, I reunited with my good friend Carlos Delgado, who I played 10 of my 16 years in professional baseball with, 3 in the minor leagues and 7 in the major leagues.
On a couple of different teams. A
couple of different teams, yep, with Toronto and then a year and a half with the Mets. And we really talked a lot about hitting there, about approach, and he's like a big brother to me, so he helped me kind of get grounded and get back on track.
You were one of the premier power hitters in the late 90s and early 2000s. Did you feel pressure to hit a home run? Can you go up to the plate and actually think, I'm going to try to hit a home run?
Well, my approach, once I developed my power stroke, I was always a guy that was more of a 280 to 300 style hitter, line drives, gap to gap, a lot of doubles, and I never expected to be a home run hitter. And all of a sudden, through this meditative approach and my own method of looking at hitting, I developed more power than I would have ever thought. And once I did, I really went up there and I swung the bat really hard.
We have attempted to use steroids? Like, I'm sure you had some teammates who did.
There's a lot of teammates that, have come out in, since. And I played with Jose Canseco and he would talk openly, just like he wrote his book about it. And he would always kind of joke around with me, say, I could put 10 pounds on you in a week. And I just kind of laugh. But for me, it was never an option. I always shied away for any kind of drugs. And I actually, once I started developing power, I kind of had a little cocky attitude that I could hang with these guys. And I would try to show up to spring training even thinner, strong, but even thinner and outperform.
Well, there are a couple of ways you can hit a home run. You can muscle the ball out of the park, or you can hit it in the exact right spot and it goes out by itself. And we see little guys who, you're not a little guy, but we see little guys hit home runs.
Yeah.
They don't have steroids.
Yeah. And I didn't have the luxury of muscling balls out, because that's why I was pretty streaky with home runs. When I had everything clicking and the mechanics were on time, the balls were going to go out of the park. And when they weren't going to go out of the park. So there wasn't, some guys will, when they're struggling, they'll still manage to hit one over the fence every, 5 or 6 games.
On May 23rd, 2002, against the Milwaukee Brewers, you had one of the greatest single game performances in the history of baseball. 4 home runs, which ties a major league record. There are a lot of guys who did that, but 19 total bases, and you broke some other records as well.
Yeah, it was an interesting time, because I was really struggling. The year before, I hit 49 home runs and had the expectations really high. I started the season off in 2002, and up until about May 20th, I had 3 home runs, and I was hitting 230, and I was getting the homestand before, I was getting booed for the first time by my home crowd, which in LA isn't as common as in New York. So it was hard on me. And I was 0 for 18. I finally hit a ball for a double. The first ball hit out of the infield, the entire homestand. And then I was excited to put on my gray uniform, get on the plane and not have to deal with the booing and all the criticism. And I got to Milwaukee and, all of a sudden the zone just showed up. I'd been working hard to get towards that place. And the first game I hit 2 home runs. Next game I hit a triple, and then the 6 for 6, and it kind of kept going from there.
The zone, you say, showed up. So one ball player said that when you're in the zone, every pitch looks like a grapefruit. And when you're not in the zone, every pitch looks like a golf ball.
I think golf ball is generous. I think maybe more like a sunflower seed coming at you. It's true. I mean, everything slows down when you're right on time, and it feels like the bat's just swinging itself. You're not doing anything, just watching.
You mentioned that certain pitchers tipped off their pitches, but I get the feeling this is a very subtle thing. Would a lot of batters even alerted to that possibility not be able to spot it?
Yeah, a lot of guys wouldn't be able to spot it, or they wouldn't be able to do it. And I couldn't do it the first few years of my career. Cito Gaston and some of the other coaches were really good at picking up pitches as well. But for me, I was still thinking my way so much at the plate, thinking my way through the at-bats. I had to get out of that mindset and just really be present and be aware of the pitcher to really utilize those skills.
So what are you doing now that you're retired?
Well, the book took a lot of my time, and that was a lot of fun to write. And I'm working on building a website that'll be out this summer, sports related, called jocktalk.com. And I'm just enjoying my kids.
And you assist several charities.
I do, yeah.
Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, Special Olympics, Parkinson's Foundation, the United Jewish Federation. While you were with the Dodgers, it was the Dodgers Dream Foundation. What determines which ones you're going to go with and which ones you aren't?
Yeah, there's quite a few over the years. Right now, I've been, the last 6 months or so, I've focused on some local charities, the Children's Hospital. My oldest daughter spent a couple weeks there when she was a newborn, and so that, you know, that's really dear to me. And I also have worked with a charity called Project Access that helps low-income families.
Any suggestions for the Mets? Things can't be much worse for the team that you left.
Yeah, they're in a tough spot right now, but you know,
well, they're in a tough division on top of everything.
The division's gotten much better. The Braves and the Marlins are much improved. Braves obviously got there last year as the wild card, but I think, you know, they just need to really focus as an organization on building up that farm system again and making the right moves with the current superstars they have, because it'd be tough to let a guy like Jose Reyes go, but if they feel like there's financially they can't do it, then they better get something really good for guys like him and David Wright. I think those two guys should stay Mets forever.
Well, part of the problem with somebody like Jose Reyes is that he's been described as wanting Carl Crawford-type money, and then you have to decide whether you want to pay anyone that kind of money. Maybe you shouldn't pay Carl Crawford that kind of money. I mean, you're a ball player. You wanted to get as much money as you could, if I'm sure.
Well, yeah, everyone, you know, is out to, you know, get the best situation. Not everyone will go to the top bidder, especially people that live in one place or another. You know, as a California guy, I would have taken less to stay in California in certain phases of my career. But guys, you know, from the Dominican or Venezuela or Puerto Rico or Japan, a lot of them don't live here full time. So, you know, they just want to go, one, where they're most comfortable, and two, where they're going to get the most money.
Sean Green's book, The Way of Baseball, Finding Stillness at 95 Miles Per Hour, written with the help of Gordon McAlpine and published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. That was fun.